Welcome to the Under 8 Podcast, a 3 times per week college basketball show brought to you in under 8 minutes. It is Monday, April 8th, 11:37 p.m. My name is Josh Molnix. On today's pod, UConn back-to-back for the first time since Florida in the mid-2000s. Let's talk about it all right now on the Under 8 Podcast. Josh Doering here with me in person podcast. Sure. Absolutely. Last day of the college basketball season. And it ended the same way that last year ended. And that's with Dan Hurley's UConn Huskies cutting down the nets in the Final Four. 75-60, the final score over the Purdue Boilermakers. And despite an impressive Zach Eader performance, 37 points, 10 rebounds, didn't get a ton else. It kind of felt like that was the play for UConn. Let Zach do whatever he wants and shut down the rest of the team. And 37 points out of the 60 for the Boilermakers feels like they accomplished that.
49 between him and Braden Smith.
Sure.
I mean, there are two numbers that stand out to me in this game. It's the 49. The rest of the team contributed 11 points. And it's the one made three-pointer.
Mm-hmm.
1 of 7.
Yeah.
Not only did they not make them, they didn't get to shoot them. They were going to have to win the three-point line to win this game. Simple as that. We talked about it yesterday.
Absolutely.
And UConn shot the ball well enough, and they just simply made more threes. Because they ran Purdue off the three-point line. Purdue never really figured that out. Then Edie went cold. And yes, he's still, I mean, the stats are ridiculous. 15 to 25, like you said, 37 points. But he was not good enough for 40 minutes to do this basically with the help of just Braden Smith. And Lance Jones gets in foul trouble. That was problematic. And on top of all of that, they also couldn't rebound, particularly defensively, and it wasn't just Donovan Klingon. It was Cam Spencer. It was Alex Caravan getting offensive rebounds. That just can't happen. Simply put, they didn't execute at a high enough level to beat UConn.
Yeah, I mean, which is, you know, you say, and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but 37 and 10 and the takeaway sometimes feeling like that Edie wasn't as good as he needed to be to win this game is something that feels a little bit ridiculous because it's 37 and 10 and right. It should be enough to put you in a real position to win the game. And that's not what Purdue got today.
Mm-hmm.
It was not in a position to win the game. It felt like on both ends of the court, it was Zach Edey as our focus for Dan Hurley's team. It was on one end of the floor. It was, they can feed them all they want to. We're taking everything else away. Fletcher Loyer doesn't have a field goal in the game. Lance Jones is 2 of 3, but like you said, he struggled with foul trouble for the majority of the game. And on the other end, it was, we're going to put Zach Edey in as many ball screens as possible. We're going to make him defend in space. Yep. We're going to, you know, let Cam Spencer attack right at him and just make him think and move as much as possible on that end of the floor. And especially early, and I thought he got a little bit better as the game went on, but especially early, it was clear that Zach was struggling with that a little bit. And, you know, I think we talked about it yesterday, this idea of when you go up and down this roster, there's a spot where Purdue seems to have the edge with the National Player of the Year, but everywhere else, it shouts UConn, and when you look at the box scores from this game, I think that played out in a real way.
And the other thing that I mentioned, the one other spot Purdue had was the three-point line.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was just not the case in this game. And you needed a lot of things to go right to keep it even within a couple of possessions where the under four, you feel like, okay, we got a real chance to win this game,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't get enough of those things to happen. Do you have any other game-specific thoughts, because there's something else I want to get to?
Not especially. I think, you know, just kind of death by a thousand cuts, as it always seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
Cam Spencer might be one of the bigger, from a like there aren't very many players in the last 10 years in college basketball who look more confident on big stages than Cam Spencer does. And it felt like that way pretty much all year. Yep. But that was part of why his insertion into the UConn starting lineup and onto this team this year felt like it made so much sense so fast, was because, you know, they had this target on their back. UConn did, and Cam Spencer just kind of seemed to take that on. And no matter how big the moment was, he always seemed super comfortable. He was good. 11 and 8, Tristan Newton, 25 and 7, 15 for Stephon Castle. Donovan Clingan did his thing. I thought early he wasn't great against Edie. Edie was having his way, and it felt like maybe that's exactly what UConn wanted Purdue to do early in the game, but it felt like early that was where Purdue was going to hang around if they were going to. But lots of guys doing a lot of really good things, and eventually, like Dan Hurley says they're going to, they eventually pull away from the team that they're playing.
Very quietly, Cam Spencer, we have a hard time, you like asking me about most impactful transfers.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a hard time coming up with a list outside of a couple obvious ones. Dalton Connect, Brandon Clark.
Sure.
And Nigel Williams-Goss, Gonzaga on those teams. I mean, Cam Spencer's up there.
It's a good point.
In terms of players who had really good seasons. Now, obviously, he didn't take a step up in competition. He was playing at the high major level in a very good league before. But this idea of people who come into programs with national championship expectations and make a significant positive impact.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do this without him. Now, do they win the national championship? Maybe. But they do not steamroll everybody and look like the best team in the country, sort of from start to finish, and certainly for a vast majority of the season, without what he brought to replace some of what they lost last season.
Definitely.
It's just easy to forget about him because he's one of the many very good pieces on this team. But like you said, you don't see many people come in and fit a program so perfectly and fill a need the way that Cam Spencer did from day one and did so reliably all season long.
Absolutely. What else you got?
I do want to have an interesting conversation real quick here that I think you and I disagree a little bit on this, but looking at past UConn national champions, you have a 4 seed last season that went 13-7 in conference play.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 7 seed that went 12-6 in the AAC. You have a 3 seed that went 500 in the Big East.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 2 seed that went 12-4 in the Big East, and then the 98-99 team, the first one. I mean, they were 34-2. They were a 1 seed. No questions there.
Sure.
But outside of those first two teams, once you get out of the sort of first Jim Calhoun era, there had not been last season was weird. It was 31-8, but they were still 13-7 in the Big East and did not win any kind of regular season championship. And obviously the last two teams had, you know, Kemba and Shabazz and the magic that happened. That's part of UConn at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like it was maybe important is too strong of a word, but when you go and dominate a season the way that they did, and not just did this non-conference thing again, but steamrolled through the Big East too, and then steamrolled everybody in the NCAA tournament, now we are having a different conversation about what this 2-season stretch means and about UConn in terms of where it stacks up in terms of programs. Not that 5 national championships speaks for itself.
6.
Now 6, right. I'm talking just outside of this one.
Mm-hmm.
They've won 5 before this. But it's not like they were great teams. There were a lot of magical, weird runs in there. This is an all-time great team to add to a couple more they had in the earlier portion of this ridiculous stretch where they win a national championship every 4 or 5 seasons going back to 1999. But I do think that is part of it here that should not get overlooked, is this is a truly great team that was consistent from start to finish, that has the not just the national championship, but the regular season to show for it in a very good top-heavy Big East. And now they've also got the back-to-back thing, which nobody had done since Florida in 06-07. that is part of this for me as well that should be recognized, is I think this takes UConn to a whole nother level, not just because they got to six, but because of the way that they did it. It's different than what we have been accustomed to in their recent national championships.
Yeah, but they're still the best winners in the sport in the last 50 years.
Yes, there is that part of it too.
Like, I don't really care how many times Kentucky goes to the Elite Eight if they never won a national championship. At the end of the day, they've got more bolded NCAA tournaments next to their names on the college basketball reference page than anything else. I think it's fair. Like, I also think that the conversation between the conversation between most dominant teams and most successful winning programs, yes, can be a different, absolutely, thing.
Right. And that's basically, that's the point I'm getting at, is that this takes them into a different echelon for me in terms of most dominant.
Sure.
Not that it's number one by any imagination, but we know they know how to win better in March than anybody else. They've already proven that with the other five.
Sure.
But now you have another dominant season on top of that, where it's not just, oh, remember the magical run. Mm-hmm. It's remember how ridiculously good this team was all season long, when people were just trying to, I mean, Butler's going to go out, our alma mater's going to go out there and try and claim some kind of trophy here for playing them to double digits twice.
Right. Yeah, I think.
Or sorry, single
digits. I think the further we get removed from this, the more I'll think about it as a two-year run than a one-year run, because they were relatively dominant except for one like month stretch, which I granted is a fifth of the season. So I hear you. I just think, and maybe it's the Dan Hurley thing, maybe it's the, I don't know, because I think you're right. I think this team, the idea that this team and last year's team should be put in the conversation about which one is better is frankly a bit silly. You don't have to look that hard to really really understand which team is the better one. But maybe it's just because this kind of thing doesn't happen very often, but there were certainly times in both years where it was, you know, of course, this year they were from start to finish the best team in the country. Yeah. Last year, for large chunks of the season, I guess, you know, back half and non-conference specifically.
At least one of the best two.
Right, at least one of the best two, if not the best team in the country. So I think that's probably part of it for me. But this stretch goes from, this stretch means something a little bit different, I would agree, because of the dominance of the start to finish.
Right. Because now you have to give the benefit of the doubt to last season and say something weird happened in Big East play.
Sure.
Because now it's not just one season. It's a much bigger body of work where they've lost, what, one game against a non-Big East opponent, mm-hmm, right? That is ridiculous over a two-year stretch.
Right.
That's non-conference where they've challenged themselves. That's, you know, Thanksgiving tournaments, MTEs, as we like to call them now. That's the NCAA tournament.
Mm-hmm.
It is preposterously difficult to do that. And, yeah, they proved this season that you got to sort of give them, because last year was just weird, where I feel like you could spin it any way you wanted to. So the question was, what are you doing for an encore? And, well, here we are.
Doesn't feel like it's going to slow down anytime soon.
No, it's the weird thing, because I mean, there are a lot of pieces you're probably going to have to replace, but then again, there were a lot last season.
Yeah.
And right, you're not doubting Dan Hurley's ability to do it. I think we just need to accept that you can't, and I was kind of talking to you about this just in our conversations this week, but I have to get out of the mindset of thinking about it in terms of what you have to replace, because it just works differently. Where who wouldn't want to, like Cam Spencer, what high-level transfers don't want to come into this program when there are clear holes that need to be filled? Then you go, well, we're expected to compete for a national championship.
Right.
Why wouldn't I want to play here?
Right.
So it's not like you have to. There will be plenty of options and ways to fill these gaps. Now, can they do it again? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. You can't. I think it was fair to question whether they could do it again at the beginning of the season. They obviously proved the answer was yes. Now you got to just sort of assume this is the baseline we're operating from until they prove otherwise.
It's a what will they add, not a what do they need to replace.
Right.
Which is basically the same thing, but one implies that it's not a foregone conclusion that they'll at least on paper replace what they need to replace. And I think after this year, it's a fair thing in the current landscape of the sport and what you just said to operate under an assumption that there will be guys, there will be proven college basketball players, there will be five stars, there will be a lot of those, you know, maybe say of the 7-footer that could be a lot, that's a lottery pick, maybe save, maybe you're not getting that every year, but there's a lot of this that can, that I feel that you can be confident in UConn just kind of being there because the situation is so, it's so good. And, you know, the first thing Dan Hurley said in his post-game press conference, I mean, post-game interview on the court tonight was UConn's a great place to do this. Mm-hmm. UConn is going to give us all the support that we need over and over and over again. And whether that was calculated or not, basically what he's saying is that we did it and we're going to come do it again next year. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to prove that you can beat us in what we're doing right now. Because right now the answer across the sport is that we're doing it better than you. And every other player that is trying to increase their value, their worth as a player trying to get to a different level of winning, that's the place that you go. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing going on at UConn right now that will limit what could happen, the players that could come. And for the rest of the sport, that's a pretty scary proposition because they walked through this tournament and then was clearly, you know, they outmatched the team who was kind of in the conversation with them the entire season. So it'll be very interesting because it doesn't feel like we're losing any steam. I suppose there's a slight chance it's disrupted by the, you know, coaching vacancy in Lexington. Maybe we can get to that here in a second. I would be very, very surprised if it was interrupted by the coaching vacancy in Lexington. Absolutely. Why? But UConn should be right there again next year. And for all the reasons that we said over the last few minutes, there's no reason to suggest they won't be in a situation to fight for another one.
And that to me is this will be my final thought. That to me is the difference. It has never felt in basically the time that we have been cognitively able to process college basketball like everybody was chasing UConn. Despite all the national championships.
It's a good point.
Right. That is what is different now, is that it is just very clear that is the standard. This sport is going through stores, and I mean, I'm not ruling out the possibility they win two national championships next year with what the women's team has coming back. But at least on the men's side, this sport goes through stores, and you can win as many NCAA tournaments and 6-game stretches as you want. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make me feel that way. Doing what they did last season in non-conference over most of the season and then this season in such dominant fashion, there is no argument otherwise. This is the bar. Somebody else has got to go reach it.
It's a really good point because, I mean, those two teams that won titles in the first half of the 2010s were combined 64-17. Mm-hmm. That's ludicrous. And granted, you get to a high, you know, to the mid to – you know, if you win a national championship and you're a team that's even kind of thought of as a team capable of winning a national championship, you're going to get to somewhere in the low 30s in terms of wins for a season. Of course, you've gone 36-3 this year, 37-3,
yeah.
37-3. That doesn't look different from last year. Last year was 31-8. Those 2 years were 32-8 and 32-9. So, but it's a great point. We don't remember either of those UConn teams as dominant or one of the best teams in the country. We remember them as, you know, Cardiac Kemba. We remember them as Shabazz Napier. And
people talk about that Kemba team because I know they went 5-5 to win the Big East tournament. But they're acting like that team was playing for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That team, I believe, was undefeated in tournaments that season? As in
that would suggest that's correct because they were 9-9 in
right.
conference yes. play and finished right. 32-9. Yes. So
thank you.
It would have to
quick
be
math there. Yes. Yeah. Right. They didn't lose non-conference game. The narrative of that is always fascinating. Not that we need to get in this conversation now, but that narrative is always fascinating to me. That yeah, that was a good basketball team most of the season that played in a really tough Big East, went 500, got some magic going, and then just kept it going. Mm-hmm. So it is weird, but right, they were not the best team in the country from start to finish. This team was. That's something different.
Dan Hurley, now in year 6 at UConn. Feels like he's been there for way longer. Yeah, it feels like he hasn't been there for it feels like he's been there for 4 years, not 6 years. I don't really know why, but 16-17, 19-12, 15-8 in the COVID year, 23-10, 31-8, 37-3. Sure.
Yeah. Zero NCAA tournament wins until last season.
It's quite wild to go from 0-2 in the tournament to 12-0 in the tournament over 2 year stretches that are back to back.
I remember saying at the beginning of last season, he's got to get some tournament wins.
At some point,
they need to not just be a good team, but they need to get back to being UConn in the NCAA tournament. And here we are saying.
And that 21-22 team, that was the first team, them losing in the first round, that was the first team at UConn under Hurley that I felt like really fell short.
Yes.
By not winning a game right. in the tournament.
It was a 5 seed. It's not like it was the end of the world.
Sure.
But at
sure.
some point something needed to change pretty quickly. And well, boy, did it ever.
Right. and even more specifically in the last 13 months or so, yeah. because like you said, that was a 4 seed last year. It was an excellent team. One that was better than a 4 seed would suggest, but was still not the dominant force that this one was from start to finish. Anything else on UConn, Purdue, the season before we finish on a very quick Calipari note?
Yeah, don't talk to me about this being a failure for Purdue.
Yeah.
They got to a national championship game. They did what they needed to do. They got the monkey off their back. They were the second best team in the country.
Yeah.
It's exactly how I feel about that Gonzaga team that lost North Carolina. They just ran into a team that is better than them and was better than them on the night when it mattered. Simple as that.
And the Gonzaga team that ran into Baylor a couple years later.
Right. That team too. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it needs to be anything. I don't think it needs to be anything more than that. I was pretty convinced by the time we got to the Final Four that there was that I wanted to see those two teams play, but that there was a clear one and a mm-hmm. clear two.
Sure.
And that's how I will come away feeling, but I don't think I think it would be silly to think of this season as anything other than a success and one that, you know, took Purdue to a place that they haven't been in a really long time, and they just so happened to run into a team that was doing really, really special things, and that's just the way it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
John Calipari is going to coach the Arkansas Razorbacks.
Yeah, apparently.
Apparently, in theory. I think the most interesting thing here is a couple things. One, you know what you're getting in John Calipari, especially when he's going to go basically from one SEC school that will never say no to him and give him as much NIL money as he wants to another SEC school that will never say no to him and give him as much NIL money as he wants. So it's interesting in that perspective because, you know, Kentucky fans seem to basically be done with yep. him and his immediate recent NCAA tournament performances. Feels like, I mean, I think the Eric Musselman and like just the end of his time at Arkansas was weird in general. And so it's a very interesting one. It's just very interesting from that perspective because I don't think you're going to get a new Calipari just because he went to a different school. I think it's still very much the same Calipari focused on the same things. And then, of course, the ripple effect that comes with a job like Kentucky opening up.
Yeah, it is. I find this incredibly fascinating that this all traces back to SMU.
Hmm.
A program that, if I remember when I did the research earlier correctly, two NCAA tournament wins since 1993. Sorry, two NCAA tournament appearances since 1993 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Andy Enfield doesn't take that job, Musselman doesn't take USC because it's not open. Arkansas doesn't have the opening. Calipari doesn't decide to take it. The idea of this all tracing back to SMU, I just find amusing.
Sure.
And then the second part of this is from an Arkansas standpoint, right? What are you expecting? Because you just had a coach who was one of the best in the country at winning in the NCAA tournament. He also squandered a lot of potential. Yeah. Not entirely always his fault. Certainly injuries were part of that. Sometimes he kind of salvaged his team specifically two seasons ago,
mm-hmm.
where they kind of pieced it together by the end of the season and again showed up in the NCAA tournament. This season was a train wreck. Maybe it's time for a fresh start from that perspective and to kind of just go in a different direction. But what are you going for here? Are you going for the name brand recognition to you're looking at, okay, Alabama just made a Final Four. We know Kentucky, Tennessee is one of the best programs in the country. Bruce Pearl's got Auburn as a top 15 or so program in the country. We need to get ourselves to that point consistently because mm-hmm. that's always been my thing with Mus is they haven't lived up to the potential in the regular season. Okay, Calipari might help you do that. Now, he hasn't been steamrolling the SEC here,
mm-hmm.
but there has been some, you know, they had a really good season this season. There is no denying that. Mm-hmm. The second part is to me, if you ask me which one is more likely to win a championship, I am really tempted to say Eric Musselman. Now, maybe Arkansas didn't have a choice in this and he just wanted out to go to USC. So they weren't choosing between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But we've said this before and it bears repeating again. He's not playing to win a national championship. If you are hiring him or you are keeping him as your coach, you have to accept that. Your fan base has to accept that.
Yeah.
Is Arkansas more willing to accept that? Probably, because they don't have a very good history, but not Kentucky history, because maybe one or two programs have Kentucky's history, right? You know, we're talking UCLA and maybe nobody else. I mean, UConn's getting up there at this point, but that's the part of this that's really fascinating to me is it's a very different situation that maybe it does fit better because they're not expecting national championships.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of Arkansas being one of the most talked about, highest profile, landing all of these five-star recruits, most talented teams in the country, there's value in that from a marketing standpoint that there isn't in Kentucky because that's what's expected.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of my initial thoughts on the Arkansas part of this.
Yeah, we'll see what it looks like. If nothing else, the timer restarts.
Yep.
That we're now, instead of 12 years or whatever, we're 15 years, however long it's been, late 2000s, since the clock started on Calipari in Lexington, we're restarting it in Fayetteville, and if nothing else, I think that's from a fan, program, coach, love triangle perspective, that's probably a good thing for all parties involved.
Yeah, this was not going to continue to go well. And I think you and I were both in agreement that it was more likely he was going to leave than Kentucky was going to fire.
Mm.
Because I just think he got tired of the criticism, which not entirely on one side or the other, because also, once again, his philosophy is that I'm not trying to win a national championship. You would understand why fans who don't particularly care about whether his players go on to the NBA, they care about what you do and what banners you're raising for the University of Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
take exception with that.
Yeah.
And also, you need to have, as a fan, you need to have your expectations properly adjusted to understand that whether you like it or not, this is the philosophy of your coach. So there's mixed emotions. Yeah, it wasn't working anymore. I honestly was thinking it was going to be Texas. But you're in the same kind of ballpark, familiarity with the SEC and a program that is willing to put the money there to allow Calipari to do something similar to what he did at Kentucky in a place where it probably fits better.
Anything else?
I'm very curious about we'll have more time to discuss it, but the Kentucky part of this. Who would be the top of your, if we say Jay Wright's not coming out of retirement. Dan Hurley's not leaving UConn.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making this decision. Who is your top choice, your first call? Maybe we'll just end with this.
I think it probably has to be Nate Oates right now. I think there's some, you know, from I think that if they're the things that Nate Oates deserves credit for, it's winning lots of SEC games. It's working the transfer portal. Yeah,
right.
It's
program building.
Yeah. It's seemingly turning Alabama from a once every few years program into an every year you have mm-hmm. to worry about them program.
Yep.
From an identity of the type of basketball he wants to play perspective, because if nothing else, that translates into these are the guys that I know I need to go get every single year. Familiarity with the conference. And like all of those things together, it's probably Nate Oates right now. I think there's a long list of guys that would be more than serviceable. I think that that probably the hire that gets people the most excited right now would be if you strip, you know, this borderline superstar coach in Tuscaloosa, if you just sort of take him right out from under Alabama's nose and put him in Lexington, I think that gets people fired up more than anything else right now. Assuming guys with the name like Jay Wright are not going to take the job.
Yeah. I'll keep this pretty simple. I still fundamentally believe that you cannot win a national championship playing the way Nate Oates plays unless the defense comes along and becomes elite.
I don't think it needs to be an elite defense, but it needs to be better than 111.
Well, it needs to be top 25 at least.
Yeah, historically. That's not elite.
And that's fair in terms of how you can have a whole KenPom conversation. Maybe he can do it at Kentucky in a way you can't at Alabama, although I just don't think the gap between those two programs at this point is that massive in terms of an appeal standpoint.
I would agree with that.
That's my reservation is you went from somebody who your criticism was and not lack of NCAA tournament success and lack of national championship success to a guy that you're so vulnerable playing that way. That would scare me because it's Kentucky. If it was another program that wanted success and not just national championships, absolutely. Because right from a building a program and operating a program, clearly he knows what he's doing. Look where he's got Alabama. To me, I want somebody that to get rid of all of the tension with Calipari as quickly as possible. I'm going to people that have done this before. That means Scott Drew and Billy Donovan. And I'm making both of them say no before I look anywhere else.
Okay.
After that, it becomes a very interesting conversation if they both say no.
I think it's interesting that I get it. I think it's interesting that perhaps the most very high profile job in the entire country, that one of the guys that's at the tippity top of the list is the guy who hasn't coached college basketball in mm-hmm. 15 years.
Yep.
I get it. Like I said, I understand. I know what Billy Donovan did the last time that he was coaching college basketball. I get it. I just think it's interesting. And part of it's because how I feel about what Scott Drew did pulling that Baylor program out of the absolute gutter and how I feel about Kentucky, or maybe how I feel about John Calipari. That will be interesting. I will find out how my feelings for Kentucky, if they had more to do with John Calipari or to do with Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting one for me personally, but yeah, it's hard to argue with. I still think that people would be really, really happy with Nate Oates right this second after what he's done in Tuscaloosa the last couple of years.
You're absolutely right. I'm looking more from a long-term standpoint of, can you get out of the cycle that you're in right now? And by that, I don't necessarily just mean winning and, you know, not winning NCAA tournament games mm-hmm. because clearly that's a problem right now. I just don't put a lot of stock in that. I think it's a weird confluence of events. but not being a factor in the national championship conversation to me is the bigger issue. Mm. And you can win as many regular season games as you want. If you are building teams that are fundamentally at a disadvantage in March because they're so reliant on threes, I have a major question there. I agree at the same time with the idea of if you're trying to win the press conference, I think Billy Donovan is one, Nate Oates is probably two. And can you actually pry an NBA coach away from his job is a big question. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see on this one. Very interesting.
The last thing I'll say is that Scott Drew has been the coach at Baylor since 2003. Mm-hmm. And if you took the last 3 years away, like the track record of tangible success in terms of the banners we hang in the building mm-hmm. is sparse. Now, granted, it would be unfair to not talk about the other things that Scott Drew did.
That would be my counter, is once he built his program into something in the same vicinity as Kentucky, look at the results. It just took 15 plus years to get there.
Right, and we're 15 years in, and John Calipari still, since John Calipari's tenure at Kentucky was far more successful mm-hmm. than Scott Drew's has been at Baylor.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's just that would be because I think Scott Drew is a highly respected coach that when you put his accolades side by side, and then of course you win a national championship, it changes yeah. everything. But from a side by side of some of the other best coaches of the last 20 years, it maybe doesn't look quite as impressive as you might think it does, knowing how many people like Scott Drew. Anyways, there will be plenty of time to talk about it. Plenty more time when it's not 12:13 in the morning. UConn, national champions, back-to-back, 75-60
yes.
over the Purdue Boilermakers, 75-60 in State Farm Stadium. Shout out UConn, shout out Dan Hurley, back-to-back national champions. And we'll see what happens with Calipari, see what happens with Kentucky. It'll be very interesting over the next few days, couple weeks, however long it is for that story arc to complete. That's all we got for you. That's all we got for you. We will keep in touch with postseason plans and where we go from here with the podcast. But we did it again. Another college basketball season in the books. We'll leave it there for now. Please subscribe to the Under 8 Pod wherever you find your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, subscribe on YouTube. Thank you so much for being here. We will see you next time.